Okay, now where is that located?
That's down in near Indio.
Right.
And one of the gentlemen killed was a man named Fred Alvarez. He was working for the John Peter Nichols family, as Jimmy Hughes was.
Now, these are people connected with the Cabazon Indio Wackenhut venture that we alluded to earlier.
Right. As a matter of fact, Fred Alvarez was a member of the business committee at that time and also worked for the senior Mr. Nichols in the security arena.
And again, the Miscellaneous Archive Show about InSlot. We have ways of making you sell details, all of this, for the benefit of listeners who would like to pursue it. Go ahead, caller.
All right. In 1985, Linda Streeter, Mr. Alvarez's sister.
We're now going to proceed with the next section of the phone call last week from Virginia McCullough, a Bay Area investigative reporter who was working with the late Joseph Daniel Casolaro. And we are going to proceed with the last part of her discussion. Then I'm going to take a musical break, and we will come back with an update on the cases she's working at, and I will do my best to sum up and analyze some of the key points in her discussion, because it's quite complicated. Those of you who are taping, please get ready to do so. 3, 2, 1, here we go. Now, if you could go back to the discussion again, because I want to make sure we have this on tape, to the discussion of the Barbara Walters, Geraldo Rivera investigation of the Alvarez killing and the others. Go ahead.
All right. Barbara Walters and Geraldo on 2020 did a special that where they investigated the changes in the Indian laws and the resulting control of the Indian reservations by business managers, per se. Not Indians necessarily, but business managers. And as a result of that show, Linda Streeter, Fred Alvarez's sister, was able to get the Governor Duke Magian to reopen the investigation into the triple execution of her brother and two friends. They knew who did or ordered the execution. They know how much money was paid for the execution. But the investigators were never able to get an indictment from the grand jury. And no one is saying why. But I think what you have are very frustrated investigators. And one of those was a man named Jane Gilbert, who wanted desperately to interview Michael Reconosciuto. I think because he believed what Michael said. And with Michael not able to see his attorneys and becoming more and more frustrated because he had no representation and no legal papers and no access to a law library to defend himself, he was calling Danny and I and other reporters more and more often. About that period of time, the United States government shipped him for mental competency hearings to Springfield, Missouri.
Right, right.
And in Springfield, we made arrangements, several of us, for Gene Gilbert to fly to Missouri to interview Michael. Long about that time, another attorney showed up on the scene, and it ultimately ended up where Gene Gilbert only had about an hour to interview Michael before Michael was shipped back by the Bureau of Prisons to Washington. And the attorney apparently refused to allow Michael to interact and talk with Gene Gilbert. To make a long story short, the information revealed in that 1 hour devastated Michael Reconosciuto because it revealed who the primary hitman was and how dangerous it was for Michael's family at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Michael is now back in Tacoma. And I have repeatedly requested that he get proper medical attention of the warden at Pierce County Jail. I wrote letters to both the U.S. Marshal and to the proper authorities explaining that he has a condition called sleep apnea, which requires a machine to trigger breathing at night. He's getting consistently worse on a health nature, and he's not allowed this machine that he normally sleeps with.
Mm-hmm.
When I called to check about it, I was told that the prison authorities at Pierce County Jail don't need no damn California woman telling them how to run their prison.
Mm-hmm.
So Michael remains in jail, held according to the magistrate's order, without bail, quote, because he's a danger to himself and society end quote. And Dr. Earl Bryan and Peter Vidnix have both entered declarations into the record stating that they know nothing, saw nothing, don't believe anything that is in the declaration.
Right.
Peter Vidnix's wife, I'm told, is the senior administrative assistant to Senator Byrd of West Virginia, and was a close personal friend and associate of Lowell Jensen, who is also named in the Inslaw papers.
Right. Also former Alameda County DA, as I recall. Or no, was he a judge?
Well, he is a judge now, but you were right. He was a former DA along with Ed Meese.
Right.
Now, what interested me about this when I started doing my research, Dave, was researching somebody whose feet I thought should be on the ground, somebody that the government believed enough to order a mental competency hearing on Michael.
Right.
And that was Dr. Earl Bryan. And so I started doing my homework as a writer, and I found that Dr. Earl Bryan never finished Stanford's internship. He quit a full quarter short of his complete internship at Stanford. And he went to serve under then-Governor Reagan. He is identified in numerous press reports as a neurosurgeon.
Mm-hmm.
My husband, who has it piled higher and deeper, pointed out to me that the timing was wrong, that the man could not have completed the necessary requirements for a doctor degree and a neurosurgeon expertise in the time frame. And he was right. And the doctor didn't. And so when I checked with the American Medical Association, California Medical Association, I was told Dr. Bryan was not a doctor until 1969.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, he was a key Reagan aide, both when Reagan was governor, heavily involved with some of the prison-located mind control programs, notably the abortive UCLA Center for the Study and Prevention of Violent Behavior. Go ahead.
And it's interesting to note, since you mentioned that, that Linda Streeter states that the 24-member Cabazon Indian tribe, almost without exception, each has been sent to a clinic of some kind for some type of treatment, alcohol or drug treatment.
Mm-hmm.
The business committee is very, very closely controlled by an attorney by the name of Glenn Feldman. And he resides in Phoenix, Arizona currently, but prior to that, he was the business partner and law partner of Senator Aberesk, now retired and in private practice.
From South Dakota, correct?
Correct.
Right.
And Senator Aberesk was the representative for the Iraqi and the Iranian governments.
That I did not know.
And they were also together, the attorneys who helped draft the 1978 revisions in the Bureau of Indian Affairs laws that had been so resented by the Indian communities. Then Linda Streeter, because she's considered a dissident because she wants her brother's death investigated, and those Indians who have joined with her are now being called dissidents down at the Cabazon Reservation. All of the monies normally due the other Indians have been withheld from them. Glenn Feldman, the attorney of record, supposedly for the Indian reservations, but who acknowledged to me by telephone that he was the Nichols family attorney in Florida before he ever became the attorney for the Cabazon Reservation, is fighting to stack the Indian Cabazon Indian Committee with non-Cabazon Indians and to oust Linda Streeter and the others that he calls dissidents. Well, Fred Alvarez, when he started looking into the books that he considered cooked or hyped, found things he really didn't want to find but felt obligated to reveal, and he gave interviews in 1981 to the Desert Sun.
Mm-hmm.
And as he gave the interviews, he told the Desert Sun, "I am a dead man as I talk to you." And it's in print. And he was writing his own death warrant.
Mm-hmm.
They executed him and two others. He apparently also was tortured before he was killed. The bodies lay in the heat of the desert for days, and Linda was never allowed to see them. But the house was raised shortly after the bodies were found. The investigation was closed.
Okay.
Within a couple of years, Mr. Nichols, the senior Mr. Nichols, Dr. Nichols, as they call him, wife Joanna died. She was the one who had maintained all the minutes of the Cabazon Indian books.
Correct. Okay.
When she died, Mr. Nichols took up with a young lady. And he was later convicted and sent to prison, another plush prison, for a couple of years for the contract killing of three more people.
That's a fairly light application of justice in light of the seriousness of the crime. One of the things that we have noted for many years on this broadcast is the very light treatment given to people who commit crimes on behalf of the national security establishment. Go ahead, caller.
All right. As Michael started getting material facts to me, there were many different companies who had one thing in common, Dave. They all had telephone numbers. They all said Cabazon Gas and Oil, Cabazon Wack and Hut Joint Venture, Cabazon Arms, many other DBAs, all identified by Michael as spook companies. You call the numbers up, if they even have numbers listed, and they are cellular telephones.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There's no business address on many of the letterheads. There's no way to reach these people. What Danny was digging into is he was contacting in much greater detail than I was the people who Michael told him not to. Michael would give him the name and how to contact them, shipping papers to prove they existed, and Danny would continue to go where angels fear to tread.
Mm-hmm.
And one man in particular...
Now, of course, he's an angel himself. Go ahead.
Now he's an angel himself. One man in particular, who Michael claimed was the man who arranged for the DEA agents to be on the Lockerbie Scotland crash.
That, by the way, is the bombing of Pan Am 103, which, in which a faction of U.S. intelligence is deeply implicated, and apparently, among other things, to eliminate another faction of U.S. intelligence. Go ahead.
There seems to be a war among the spooks lately.
Right. Now, could you repeat the information about the arranging for the people to be on Pan Am 103?
Yes. What, Michael indicated that one particular person arranged for the reservations for the DEA agents and spook agents to be on that flight. And there was also almost $1 million in cash.
By the
and
way,
almost $1 million in traveler's checks.
By the way, in for the benefit of listeners who are not familiar with it, Radio Free America 35 called The December Surprise, The Politics of Terror and the Exoneration of the Secret Team, and its addenda go into the so-called McKee team, a military intelligence team on loan to CIA, which was using DEA as a cover. You say there were traveler's checks involved in that, too?
Correct.
Because one of the things that was revealed in a London Times article from July 22nd of this year is that the so-called MC-10 operation, a DIA operation from which the McKee team was culled, was using, among other things, traveler's checks drawn on the BCCI's Luxembourg branch to help finance some of their operations. Go ahead.
That's correct, incidentally. And in addition to this, they were dealing liberally and selling liberally American passports. Some of the material confiscated during the drug bust that we were talking about that ended up in the Lindvest bankruptcy were passports that had been advertised on the in the London Times for sale. American passports. The drugs that were seized in that tug came from a very unusual source, and according to my sources, had to be CIA drug.
Right.
As you know or might not know, Harry Martin has placed Charles Duck on an airplane with Dr. Howard Duff.
Dr. John Duff.
Pardon me, Dr. John Duff.
Right.
It's late at night. I don't know how you'd keep these hours. But they were on their way to Costa Rica to that like it was like for Drug Island, I guess they call it.
Ila Jesus Cita, and that is, by the way, in the aforementioned miscellaneous archive show about the Drug Tug series, the first of Harry Martin's intelligence article or series that I have accessed on this program. Go ahead.
Okay. So the tie-ins of the bankruptcy trustees that are operating with the total consent and knowledge of the bankruptcy judges in areas that are surrounded by water, like San Francisco Bay, have a unique significance. And I'd like to discuss that with you at a later show as it relates to Wackenhut Corporation.
Okay.
There'll be an article coming out soon, hopefully, by John Littman, and it probably will be in the San Francisco Chronicle, regarding the huge burning plant for waste, medical waste and other waste that has been built on the Cabazon Indian Reservation.
Hmm.
Now, keeping in mind, and I can show you the Cabazon Indian minutes, that the Indians are getting nothing down there. But I can also fax you exactly how much the Nichols family is reaping as a benefit. When you have angry Indians, I think the American public ought to be fully aware that their turf given to them in the treaties has been invaded and taken over by management teams for the United States government.
Right.
They're doing everything from legal betting to controlling groundwater to polluting the air because they don't have to comply when they have these waste plants with EPA standards. Just this year, such a bill was attempted at the state level. And the Indians are being diluted, I guess is the best way you can put it, Dave.
Mm-hmm.
The families that are controlling the Indian reservations, as in the case of the Cabazons, are intermarrying with the few Indians left. And the smaller the tribe, the more ripe it is for the picking. And there have been quite a lot of mysterious deaths on the Cabazon Indian tribe. It was a small tribe to begin with, 24 members. But of the 24 members, three members of one family met mysterious deaths.
Okay.
In the last 10 years. And ultimately what will happen is the tribe will be no more. And then the entire land they control, and that's a fairly large amount of land with a great amount of groundwater, will be up for the picking. Let me see. Back to Michael, because he's on my mind and I'm concerned about him.
All right. By the way, let me jump in to interject for listeners that might have tuned in late. This is a woman calling from Sunol who worked very closely, obviously, as the text of the phone call reveals, with the late Joseph Daniel Casolaro, who was investigating Inslaw and the various tentacles of what he termed the octopus. And obviously this woman has also been in touch with Harry Martin and is very familiar with many of the details in the investigation. By the way, caller, I suspect, given your contacts, you must know how to get in touch with me. If you would feel it in your best interest from a security standpoint to do that, so you might want to call after the broadcast this evening or else make other arrangements to contact me if you feel that contact would be in the best interest of your own security, because obviously these are dark times, and I certainly want to do what I can to prevent any more deaths like Joseph Daniel Casolaro's.
I appreciate that, Dave, and I will be in touch with you after the broadcast, or at least in the next couple of days to supply you documentation.
Okay, and by the way, this particular phone call will be on permanent file with archives on audio for the benefit of other journalists and researchers who would like to access the information. Go ahead. And I certainly hope listeners are taping this. Go ahead.
Okay. The last time that we heard from Danny, the reporters that he was dealing with, he was much more centered. He understood exactly what he wanted, and he had never had that feeling with me before. He could talk your ear off. I think I got ear infections from listening to him.
I've been accused of the same thing from time to time. Go ahead.
That's what I hear. When we last talked, he only wanted information on one thing, Alan Michael May. And it was within the week preceding his death, and he said he wanted everything that I had on Alan Michael May. And at that time, I was doing taxes, and my desk was piled to the ceiling, and I managed to pull two pieces of paper, the obituary and some of my notes, and fax those to a safe fax for him. He said, when I get back from this contact, I'll have enough to bury the Justice Department in the Inslaw case. And he says, I want my mailbox full of information from you on Alan Michael May. And that's the last I talked to him. He also talked with an Arizona reporter. And to show you how centered and detailed he was, because right now there's character assassination on a dead body.
Invariably. Go ahead. Go ahead. That always happens when they bump somebody off like this. They try to make him out to be a screwball or whatever. Go ahead.
Right. He contacted a very knowledgeable reporter in Arizona who had written many articles on gold and platinum, industrial gold and platinum brokering. And that reporter told me the story of the 1977 suicide, for example, of the largest such broker. And the gentleman walked into the desert, he said, with a bulletproof vest, took a gun to his head, and blew his head off. Unfortunately, he also left a bloody tooth and parts of his skull wrapped in a towel in his car. Which is quite a trick, if you can do it.
It's not bad. It's not bad. It suggests that perhaps he might have been in contact with elements of the New Age and had transcended physical death, as so many of them claim to be able to do. Go ahead. Forgive my irony, but, as we go through so many of these killings, and I've been through so many of these over the years, covering them in a journalistic standpoint, it's... brings home to me, and I suspect your discussion is bringing home to the listeners in a way that I have not been able to, just exactly how real and how personal a threat these kinds of things can be. It's interesting that we see the Indians continuing after all these hundreds of years to be raped by the white men in this land, and I have said that everything I've learned in a better part of 20 years of political research could be summed up by the phrase, what goes around comes around, and what has been going around for the Indians is now coming around big time for those white people who would like to attempt to correct the situation. It also brings to mind a couple of things, caller, if I could interject. One, I'm very pleased to hear you using this program in this way. I want to apologize to those listeners who are hanging on, but in light of the immediacy of your situation to the Joseph Daniel Casolaro situation and also your awareness of Harry Martin's work, I would also indicate that I have never spoken with this woman before. This is not a set-up telephone call, but because of the seriousness of the situation and the gravity, no pun intended, of the situation, I feel it necessary to allow this call to proceed on course. But I have, my target audience for a long time has been other journalists and researchers in an attempt to be, as I call it, a journalistic step-up transformer. And this is arguably the ideal use for this particular broadcast. I would also call to mind, it might seem a little bit corny or maudlin perhaps, but the phrase, the passage from the John Donne poem, "Send not for to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee." Go ahead.
True. I want to just say a couple of more things. People, reporters, have not believed in what Michael Reconosciuto is saying because he's not been able to document it. And in the last couple of weeks, we finally have heard from Michael after 7 weeks of silence. And he has yet to be given by the Pierce County Jail authorities his legal papers, even though they were marked very clearly, legal papers, client attorney privileged. No one has given the papers. The National Security Agency was called in by the jail, and they reviewed the papers, but Michael has yet to get the papers. Yesterday, Michael called me, and he was absolutely freaked, and I've never heard him freaked. He had been taken by his jailers to an attorney client room, and I'm talking about a room not with any glass partition but where you normally meet with your attorney.
Mm-hmm.
Waiting for him in that room were two reporters, Mark Suter and John Shelby of KROY Seattle Television. They brought with them computer readouts of a story they had been working on for 2 years. They brought 3 pages of individuals they had interviewed. And they told Michael that it was all right for him to talk with them. Michael's a very cautious person. You don't survive in that industry that long if you're not.
I was going to say, with good reason is he being cautious. Go ahead.
The questions they asked him clearly showed someone had given them access to the papers that they were withholding from Michael. And I'm talking about a series of executive orders.
Someone had given these reporters access to them, and they'd been withholding them from Michael Reconosciuto.
That's correct.
All righty.
And Michael was freaked.
I can imagine. Go ahead.
I talked to John Shelby, and he tells me that Mr. Crawford, who is one of Michael's attorneys,
right,
had talked to him the day before they saw Michael, and Mr. Crawford had said, "I don't want to be suicided. There's not a suicide bone in my body, and I want you to understand that." Now you have attorneys who are terrified to represent a client,
mm-hmm,
for fear of their life. You have a client whose life is hanging by a thread. You have jailers who, I mean, you have to assume you have jailers who are leaking material and seeing to it that Michael is seeing people who normally could not get in to see him,
mm-hmm,
because they don't want him dead on their shift.
Mm-hmm.
And you have two men, one of who has been accused of cooking his books at Financial News Network and burying UPI and blackmailing and accusing or trying to buy a company and then stating that if you don't sell it to me, I have ways of making you sell it to me.
Mm-hmm.
A man they call Dr. Earl Bryan.
Also a person, by the way, who figures, according to Michael Reconosciuto and Ari Ben-Menashe, in the October surprise, and Michael has stated that the pirating of the Promise software was in part to pay off Brian for his October surprise role.
Correct, and he's known by a couple of nicknames. One is Big Daddy.
That is to say Brian.
That's right.
Okay.
The other is Cash, and he's known both in the intelligence communities and by those closest to him by the name Cash. And I think that says it all, Dave.
Okay.
The only other thing I want to say, because we're in Silicon Valley, my husband has started three computer companies. He holds 7 patents on one of the machines that's now in Moscow. Okay?
Okay.
They tried to launder his chipset design through the bankruptcy courts. We've endured bomb threats, death threats, attempted arson on our home. We jailed our bankruptcy trustee, and we're just now begun to fight. And through all of this, there is an army of people out there whose technology is being stolen by their own government and laundered through to political cronies. And the government is using an entity that was created and extended by President Reagan when he first took office. Congress didn't want it extended, but an executive order extended a entity called Operation Exodus.
All righty, and that was?
Controlling through export laws the export of high technology. At the whim and the will of those few chosen people who don't either understand it or know how to use it, the likes of Mr. Bush, who's just now taking his first course in computers.
By the way, I would jump in again, and I want to emphasize, since we are speaking for the benefit of people who hear this program by tape, eventually, we are in the Santa Clara or Silicon Valley, the capital of the world's computer industry. And I would note, for the benefit of people here in the Valley, perhaps some of you Silicon Valley entrepreneur types, don't think that some of the things that I talk about on these broadcasts are going to affect you. Perhaps you just think you're going to score your little business coup and develop your technologies and buy your nice home and your fancy car and get off scot-free. Well, as I've said, everything I've learned in almost 20 years of political research and 12 years on the air could be summed up by the phrase, what goes around comes around. So what has been going around for a lot of other people will be coming around at some point for you. Don't think that you're going to be exempted. I would also cite in this connection a very important insight by a French sociologist and writer and a political researcher named Daniel Guérin, who in a book called Fascism and Big Business, which is relevant to the material like I've covered on the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcasts every Memorial Day, points out that among the very first victims of fascism are small and medium-sized businesses. It isn't just socialists, quote-unquote, or reds, quote-unquote, or radicals, quote-unquote, who buy it. Among the very first and most prominent victims are small and middle-sized business people who are devoured by their larger and more powerful competitors. And I would strongly encourage those people here in the Silicon Valley who think that they're going to be immune from the types of depredations we have been describing on this program for so many years and that this woman has been relating for us, don't think you're going to be exempt. You are not immune. Only activity will buy your freedom and continued integrity. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll make this short and conclude this way, but I see a very grave danger in this type of control. The control was introduced so that the evil empire wouldn't attack America. But the control has another purpose. The control is to monitor very closely, as in the case of the Promis software or the old Magnuson machines or a chipset design, the state of the art. I'm friends with a woman who has a company, and she's a brilliant German immunologist. Her company is in South City.
Mm-hmm.
They are trying to steal her company. They stole the first one. They're trying to close down the second, so that the second one, which is now successful, is not competition to the first they stole.
Mm-hmm.
They do it in every single technology, and it's become a very well-greased machine. When they busted Mr. McVeigh in 1983 at a company called Land Management in Orange County, and they seized his airplane, and they filled the boxes full of concrete and sent them on to Moscow, they succeeded in using the publicity from that case to fund an executive order that was Operation Exodus.
Mm-hmm.
William Fahey and now Judge Stephen Trott signed the indictment papers on Mr. McVeigh.
Stephen Trott had previously, as I recall, argued the Inslaw case. Am I thinking the same person who had argued Inslaw against Inslaw on behalf of Justice Department, or am I confusing him with another person?
I think you're confusing him.
Okay, go ahead.
But in any case, William Fahey, when he went up to try to extradite Mr. McVeigh
mm-hmm.
on the 1983 case, was found guilty of perjury by the Canadian justice of altering the papers that he brought up to Canada to testify. In other words, the United States prosecutor was found guilty of lying, and Mr. McVeigh, from his jail cell, won that case through the appeals level unanimously. On the 1987 phony Saxby supercomputer charges that were brought, the low-key IBM Hitachi sting operation, which was bored by Mr. Altshuler, Leland Altshuler in San Jose, and Russinello in San Francisco, they lost their case, too. Mr. Altshuler was sent back by the Canadian justice to look up United States law twice in the law library as he argued his case in Canada. So Mr. McVeigh now sits free at 68, having lost his wife. I drove her up there, and she died 48 hours after she first embraced him after 2.5 years.
Mm.
He spent 2.5 years in a Vancouver pretrial awaiting extradition. The United States government lost both cases on the appeals level and is now fast-tracking them to the Supreme Court in Canada. And because they're so greedy for that man's body, they are now trying to deport him to Guatemala. Be careful what you wish for. As the French say, you might get it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of Mr. McVeigh, I think the only reason that he's still alive, Dave, is he never gets mad, but he does get even.
Mm-hmm.
So the material that I have come from several sources. The Cabazon Indians, a lot of it from Danny. The financial network is very detailed and easily figured out now. And the names of the people that Mr. Ansoning was going down to see in Guatemala are already in the hands of the media networks. Right now, the 7 boxes of material that Danny Casolaro had in his home that the United States government is saying never existed are in the hands of Nightline.
Okay, good.
And I thank you for your time.
All righty. Well, I also thank you for your time. I wanted to say a couple of things in conclusion since we're all out of time for the phone-in session. I want to apologize for listeners that are hanging on or trying to get through. This certainly... Thank you.
righty. Welcome back live to One Step Beyond. We're now going to proceed with the prepared portion of tonight's broadcast. I have hanging on with me Ms. Virginia McCullough. That is the reporter and investigator who you have been listening to. And we're going to, God willing, and the creek don't rise, get her on here live. Good evening, Virginia.
Good evening.
All right. We've got you live here. Terrific. Okay. You're live in front of the KFJC audience. And what I'm going to do first is attempt to sum up and highlight the main points as best I can of the hour and a quarter or so that we've just listened to. By the way, the audience has just listened to a rebroadcast of our long phone call last week. Now, the basic thrust of that phone call was your discussion of the subject that Daniel Casolaro had been investigating at the time of his murder. It has been officially listed as a suicide, but you pointed out that not only did Danny Casolaro have a bruised bicep, but also the police, you found out that the hotel room, the motel room in which he had been murdered, had been industrially cleaned. Is this correct?
That's correct.
Now, he had been investigating a number of different connections of what he called the Octopus, which were a number of different U.S. intelligence operations intersecting and involving both gun running, drug running, and money laundering. This would include the October Surprise, the Inslaw case, the Iran-Contra scandal, and the BCCI scandal. Now, you referred to an operation, you referred to a sum of money called that you termed the New World Order Slush Fund, which in turn involved an intelligence operation known as the Black Rose, or codenamed the Black Rose, which involved the generation of funds from the Southeast Asian drug traffic, and in turn the use of these funds through not only the Nugenhan Bank, a CIA and naval intelligence operation in Australia, but then later using BBRDW, Bishop Baldwin, Rewald, Dillingham, and Wong, another CIA financial institution. And ultimately, these funds were traced to the BCCI. You mentioned that one of the main people involved in this was Dr. Earl Bryan, a former Reagan aide, and an individual whose name has cropped up in a big way, not only in connection with Inslaw, but the October Surprise. You mentioned that his nicknames in the intelligence community were Big Daddy and Cash. You also mentioned that a colleague of Joseph Casolaro's, a journalist named Anson Ng Yang, had been murdered in Guatemala, and he had been pursuing the links of the Black Rose financing to the BCCI. At any point, if I miss something here, Virginia, please correct me.
Well, let me just comment here, too, Dave, mm-hmm. that one of the gentlemen that Mr. Ng was down there to interview was a bag man by the name of Jimmy Hughes, and that plays a very important part in the Cabazon Indian Reservation connection.
Now, you mentioned he had also been involved with Dr. John Nichols, one of the main people involved with that.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, another name that two names that are very important here in connection with what Danny Casolaro was investigating. One is the name of Michael Reconosciuto, an individual who, by his own account, has worked for the CIA in the past, a principal figure involved with the Inslaw case. And also a fellow named Alan Michael May, one of the individuals cited in Harry Martin's Napa Sentinel article of June 14th of 1991 as a key figure involved in the $40 million money transfer that initially primed the financial pumps for the October Surprise weapons transfers. Now, Daniel Casolaro had received a number of pieces of information from Michael Reconosciuto and was investigating those, including a Reconosciuto tip which put Danny Casolaro onto the name of the individual who had apparently booked the McKee team, U.S. intelligence operatives using a DEA cover, onto the Pan Am 103 bombing. Now, Alan Michael May expressed fear to Harry Martin when he learned that Harry was going to publish this information. And the information was published on June 14th, a Friday, and on Wednesday, June 19th, Alan Michael May was found dead in his home of an apparent heart attack. You mentioned in the broadcast that on July 26th, a coroner report was released which listed the cause of death as pulmonary failure and complications from diabetes as a result of, quote, polypharmaceuticals, meaning the presence in Alan Michael May's body of a large number of drugs, and upon inquiry you found out that those were not over-the-counter prescription drugs, so in all probability they were introduced in him to produce the fatality. Now, Michael Reconosciuto had been interviewed by people from the House Judiciary Committee in connection with the Inslaw case, and when they asked for proof, for documentation to prove his bona fides, the information which was being transmitted to him under the attorney-client privilege was intercepted by a National Security Agency team, which then, illegally, of course, which then refused to allow Michael Reconosciuto's access to that particular operation. You alluded to an attorney named Dennis H. Eisman, E-I-S-M-A-N-N, as I recall, an individual who had been involved in the Jeffrey McDonald case, the Fatal Vision case. Eisman had been an attorney, or was going to serve as an attorney, for Michael Reconosciuto to help free up that information. He was then found dead. Supposedly, he was going to be indicted for drug operations and took his own life. And that
well, hold it.
Okay.
No, he did not take his own life. In fact, he
what,
was...
No, this supposedly, I'm saying.
Supposedly,
not,
but
supposedly.
In fact, recently, since we last talked, Dave, information mm-hmm. has come forward that the woman whom Mr. Eisman was to meet with and bring information to Washington from
mm-hmm.
has now been arrested.
Okay.
By police and charged with the EA violations. And I want to state at this point that there is, in fact, everything that Ollie North wanted, which was a method to control political dissidents within the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It's my belief that that method is in effect and in control and under the auspices of the Wackenhut Corporation. They control a number of lower entities within the prison system. In San Antonio, they control the jail system. They control some transportation facilities within the Bureau of Prisons. And, in fact, they have a hit list for journalists coded into a computer. It's my understanding that those codes are into a computer network using the PROMIS software.
When you say a hit list, do you mean that quite literally, hit in the sense of kill?
I mean quite literally a hit list.
Mm-hmm.
I talked with several entities earlier this afternoon. I have the computer codes for the hit list. The hit list includes ABC News Network crews, individuals at length who have been investigating this. And what I've been told is that these are damage control individuals from Wackenhut who has initially about a 45,000 member employment. In addition to that, through Westinghouse Security Corporation,
mm-hmm.
they have approximately another 45,000 to 50,000 employees at their disposal.
Okay, Virginia, I'd like to finish. Let's go into this when we get to fresh material, because what I would like to do before for the benefit of listeners, many of whom are probably getting pretty confused at this point by the tangle of names, is to give a synoptic account and to highlight the main points of the previous call. Then we'll proceed with new material. Now, going back again to the withholding of information, the intercept by an NSA team, National Security Agency team, of this corroborating information being passed to Michael Reconosciuto by his attorneys. Dennis H. Eisman, one of the attorneys who was going to help free this up, then was, quote, suicided, unquote, another phony suicide, supposedly because he was going to be indicted for drug offenses. Upon checking with other attorneys supposedly in the same category, you found out that that was nonsense. Later, the prison authorities in Pierce County took, I should also mention that there is a machine, a breathing machine, that Michael Reconosciuto normally needs to help him stay alive, and prison authorities have denied him the use of this machine, thereby placing his life in jeopardy. One of the most terrifying things that you presented involved the prison authorities bringing Michael Reconosciuto into an attorney-client room at the prison, where he met with two reporters named Mike Souter and John Shelby. How is Souter's name spelled, by the way?
It's S-O-U-T-E-R.
Just like the Supreme Court Justice.
Correct, okay. And I caution Mike Souter that his name is on that list this evening. He has not yet been notified.
Okay, and these two individuals met with Michael Reconosciuto, and they obviously had information leaked to them from the intercepted material that the NSA had refused to let Michael Reconosciuto get a hold of. And the main name in connection with this was a fellow named Crawford, who was one of Michael Reconosciuto's attorneys, who was basically getting this information out to these reporters because Mr. Crawford himself apparently feared for his life if he represented Michael Reconosciuto. Now, we also went into the murders of a number of the Indians at the Cabazon Indian Reservation in Indio, California, who had objected to the joint Wackenhut the joint Wackenhut Cabazon venture vis-a-vis Inslaw. And by the way, once again, for the benefit of listeners that are new to this material, These various cases all intersect, and many of them have been accessed by Harry Martin in the Napa Sentinel. They are also available in archive shows from Archives on Audio. If a lot of this seems mysterious to you, it's because there are an awful lot of elements involved, and the discussion involved here has been going on for a number of years, and so there's no way I can provide a simple synoptic account. Under the circumstances, I simply encourage listeners who want to pursue these things to get into the archives under the circumstances.